This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A verbal gaffe that unintentionally leads the British to join the U.S. in planning a war against a country in the Middle East. Gaffes and spin and ideological political agendas that lead to war are the subject of the political satire In the Loop. The war in the film is against an unnamed country in the Middle East, but the film makes intentional parallels to the lead-up to the war in Iraq. My guest is the writer and director of the film, Armando Iannucci. The main characters in the film are adapted from his BBC series, The Thick of It. Early in the film, the British Minister for International Development is asked by a journalist about the possibility of war. He responds that war is unforeseeable, which is incorrectly interpreted as inevitable, which is not what the official government position is. This leads to a series of disastrous misunderstandings in England and in the U.S., where the minister is sent to meet with other mid-level officials. Here's a scene right after that unforeseeable gaffe. The minister, played by Tom Hollander, is in hot water because of the gaffe. Things get even worse when he runs into a pack of reporters.
Hello there. Hi.
So is war unforeseeable, Minister?
Look, all sorts of things that are actually very likely are also unforeseeable. For the plane in the fog, the mountain is unforeseeable, but then it is suddenly very real and inevitable.
Right.
Is this your opinion, or is this the government position?
The mountain in the metaphor is a completely hypothetical mountain that could represent anything.
Sorry, Minister, I'm unclear.
What I'm saying is that to walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict. Thank you so much.
You've been climbing the mountain alone, Minister.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's it, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Armando Iannucci, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, since spin is so important in your movie and political language and evasive political language, were you listening very closely during the lead-up to the Iraq war, both because you wanted to know what was going to happen, but also just to hear the words that the politicians were using to say or hide what their intentions were?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was listening very intently, principally because I was frustrated by the fact that you could clearly see there was a headlong, unstoppable rush towards war, coupled with all these public statements that every avenue was being explored, every possible attempt to defuse the situation was being explored. And so there was this conflict between what was clearly happening and what we were being told was happening. And the whole rush towards war was full of these illogicalities, these arguments that said, for example, you know, Saddam would attack us if we invaded him. Therefore, we have to invade him to stop him using the weapons that he's going to use on us once we invade him. It's a sort of an abuse of argument and an abuse of language. And Rumsfeld was very, very famous for it. You know, we all remember his "there are no known knowns and known unknowns," and, you know, his very enigmatic press conferences.
What's one or two of the favorite lines you and your writers came up with for your movie?
Well, Malcolm, once the minister says war is unforeseeable, Malcolm Tucker, the government's chief spin doctor, then rings around all the press and tries to roll back from that. And he does. There is a shot of him walking out of number 10 Downing Street on the phone to a journalist saying, "You may have heard him say that, but he did not say it," which I quite like. It's that truth is really a very relative thing. Truth is what you make it, that I think sort of underpins the comedy and the thinking behind the film, really.
I think I have a scene that will illustrate that I'd like to play. And this is a scene from early in the film where the head of a secret war committee is meeting with his aide. And the head of the secret war committee's name is Linton Barwich. Tell us a little bit about this character before we hear the scene.
Linton Barwich is he's the undersecretary of state in charge of policy at the State Department. And he is fundamentally an amalgam of all the intellectually driven neocons like Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton and Rumsfeld, there is a sort of an arrogance about their belief in their intellectual rightness that overrides everything else. And talking to people who worked with them, I arrived at this impression that they were sort of bullies, but they were intellectual bullies, and their bullying took the form of just deciding that not to connect with anyone who disagreed with them.
So here's a neocon Lyndon Borwick meeting with his aide, who has just gotten back from London.
Now, what else happened in London?
Generally positive. Two glitches.
Really, what?
Karen flagged a report by one of her staffers.
Really?
She's obviously trying to use it as some kind of roadblock. It's called Quip Pip.
Quip what?
Quip Pip.
What is it, a report on bird calls? What does it even stand for?
I can't recall, but it's factish. Intel for and against intervention.
We have all the facts on this we need. We don't need any more facts. In the land of truth, my friend, the man with one fact is the king. All right, you said there was something else. What is that?
In the meeting with the Foreign Office, the committee was accidentally and briefly alluded to.
Which committee?
The War Committee, sir.
All right. Karen is not to know about this, huh? She is an excitable, yapping she-dog. All right, we've got to get a hold of those minutes. I have to correct the record.
We can do that?
Yes, we can. Those minutes are an aide memoir for us. They should not be a reductive record of what happened to have been said, but they should be a more full record of what was intended to have been said. I think that's the more accurate version, don't you?
Sir.
Right.
I really like that the minute should be a memoir for us.
Yes.
Of what
yes.
we intended to say.
And so it's not that thing of, like, you know, the truth is what you make it. And a lot of when I came out to research the film and spoke to people in the CIA and the Pentagon and so on, they were all saying that the evidence that was being presented to the neocons was evidence that they wanted to hear. You know, there was already a sort of selective filtering going on because nobody wanted to lose their job. And when they were actually given evidence that said there are no weapons of mass destruction, rather than the neocons saying, oh, well, let's call the whole thing off, their attitude was, well, that must mean they're hiding them. So it's that notion that they've made their conclusion in advance, and then you go out and you find knowledge that will back up that conclusion rather than the other way around.
One of the dynamics in the film is that when the British political aides come to the United States to meet with American leaders there, they're seen as relatively inconsequential.
Oh, absolutely. And they go out to Washington feeling that they are quite important and are going to be feted and are going to have a major say. And then they turn out to be, the phrase they use is room meat in the room, just numbers, bulk for the different factions that want them out there. And that's based on two things, actually. That's based on what actually happened when Blair and his entourage came out to Washington. Blair thought he was coming out to try and stop George Bush going to war. But in fact, it was Blair's presence in America and his presence standing beside George Bush that actually encouraged the pro-war faction to go to war. And so Blair was really there as a number. And also, they from all accounts, they got a little bit giddy. They kind of lost their cool and got slightly kind of excited being in the White House and being in the Oval Room and being on the international stage and being considered public figures. And I reminded the UK cast when we were shooting these scenes, I said, try and remember what it was like the first time you went out to Hollywood. You went out to LA and you had all sorts of meetings and all sorts of agents came and talked to you and said how great you were and how you thought it was all going to change. And then after your stay in Hollywood for, what, 3 or 4 days, you went home empty-handed with nothing and how you'd felt used and soiled. And yet when you got home, how you had returned to a very drab, grey, rainy London and were already pining for those hot, sunny days in LA when people were telling you how great you were. And
oh, it sounds like this happened to you.
Well, it did actually. There was the film is a sort of an offshoot of a TV show I do with the BBC called The Thick of It, which is set in a government ministry in London. And there was an attempt to make they made an American pilot of it for ABC, set in Congress. And I came out to LA, and it was my first trip out, and you know, I was wined and dined, and everyone told me how great it was going to be, and everyone I met was called vice president. They were all about 23 years old, but they're all vice president commissioning, vice president comedy artifacts, vice president valet services. So all these vice presidents said how good it was going to be, and then And then I realized I was a tiny cog in a huge machine. I went to one meeting. My whole involvement in the project was going to one meeting, which was a meeting to talk about the costumes and the color of the ties that the cast were going to wear. And there were 30 people in the room. And after that meeting, I just thought, this is ridiculous. And the pilot itself was, it wasn't terrible. It was just dull. So despite the fact that all these vice presidents were working on it, in fact, the quality of it wasn't that high. And I thought that was kind of an interesting eye-opener, really, the fact that, you know, you when you're on the outside and you look in, you think these things are going to be glamorous. And similarly, in you know, you go through Washington, you see these buildings, you know, the Pentagon, the State Department, they look very imposing. You think the people behind them who work in them know what they're doing. And yet, you know, you walk in, you find out that you know, in fact, they didn't know what they were doing. I remember reading an account of, I think it was in one of Bob Woodward's books on the behind the scenes in the lead up to Iraq. They were talking about when there were meetings at the White House, when somebody said, so once we've invaded, then what do we do? And of course, no one had really thought that through. And what happened whenever anyone asked that question was everyone else in the room would just bow their heads and stare at the carpet. Like that thing you do at school if you don't know the answer. If you look down, trying to tell yourself that if you can't see the teacher can't see you. And I just thought, that's interesting. They're behaving like kids.
So did you go to Washington yourself and get into the big impressive buildings and try to see what goes on inside?
Yes, I did a couple of above the board meetings with staffers and people who'd worked in the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department. But I'd also...
How did you set them up? Did you call and say, I'm a filmmaker, I'm doing political satire in which you will be mocked, so please let me come meet with you?
Yeah, more or less, yes. That is the interesting thing. Politicians love it when they are being portrayed in drama and in comedy, and it doesn't really matter how terrible they're being portrayed. The film opens with Malcolm Tucker walking out the front door of number 10 Downing Street. And most often when you're doing that in a film, you have to go to a set. We wrote to number 10 and they said yes, because they were big fans of the television show. So here was this character who was the embodiment of how crass and evil and corrupt politics is, being welcomed into the heart of government. And when we arrived to shoot the scene, all the real Malcolm Tuckers who worked in Number 10 had brought their cameras with them because they were all excited. They all wanted to meet Peter Capaldi, who plays Malcolm Tucker, and they all wanted a big team photo with Malcolm and all of them. And similarly, when I was out in Washington, you know, I was speaking to Biden's chief of staff, who was this sort of young, good-looking, really intelligent, quite charismatic guy who was saying what an exciting job it is that he has because he meets all these exciting people. And he said, do you know who we had? We had a reception last week. I met Bradley Whitford, who plays Josh in the West Wing. And I'm thinking, but you are Josh. You're the real Josh. Why are you excited to meet an actor who's only a part-time Josh? And it is that thing. I think maybe because the political world is such an enclosed bubble that they are delighted to meet someone from, you know, a real person from outside. Onto whom they can offload all their observations about how the system works. So I hooked up with people in Washington, and I was fairly clear. I said, look, I'm not making a documentary. I'm not out to name names. I'm not out to bring anyone down. In many ways, I want to know the dull stuff rather than the juicy stuff. I want
so
to know
what dull stuff did people tell you that you were
Well, I want to know what time people get in, what time they go home, who it is they work with, what people are like. And also the little things like, you know, the golden rule in Washington politics is never leave the room, never leave a meeting. If you leave a meeting, you leave power. And that's because big things are decided very, very quickly at meetings, you know, and you could be out of a meeting for 20 minutes, maybe taking a call, and something pretty major was decided when you were gone. And there's no way you can get back into it and try and claim credit for that decision. So Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, she taught her staff bladder diplomacy, which was basically how to last in a meeting for up to 6 hours without having to go to the bathroom. So it's things like that that makes you realise that, you know, international politics are being conducted on this petty office scale.
So when you were in Washington, you arranged meetings with some people. Did you also arrange to be in places that you weren't supposed to be?
Well, I was intrigued as to what the State Department looked like on the inside, because the film is set a lot in the State Department. And a journalist in Washington said, do you have any kind of BBC pass or anything? And I've got this pass, a BBC pass, and it looks very, very primitive. It is basically just my photo and my name and the words BBC. There's no watermark or serial bar or anything on it. It's just a basic, a child could have put it together. And they said, go up to the reception and say, BBC, I'm here for the 12:30. So I did, and I got in. I got into the State Department, and I thought I'd be escorted with, you know, 50 State Department officials, you know, high security. No, I was just in there on my own, myself and my researcher. And we wandered around the State Department for about half an hour. And I thought, well, let's take some photos because I need to bring them back to London and to tell the art designer what it looks like. So we were just photographing the inside of the State Department unchallenged. And then this big burly guy came down and just came up to us and went, excuse me. And I said, I'm here for the 12:30. And he said, yeah, it's over there. And just pointed us and we wandered off. And we ended up at the 12:30, which was a very, very dull press conference given by Condoleezza Rice's press spokesperson. But I was amazed by how easy it was to wander around. Part of me was thinking it was exciting, and another part of me thought this is technically international espionage we're doing here. I hope I'm not extradited or rendered.
Armando Iannucci, thank you so much for talking with us.
Been a pleasure.
Armando Iannucci wrote and directed the new political satire In the Loop.